And you're welcome to Truth Quest with Melody on KHENLP 106.9 Salida. And I have a great guest lined up this evening. And I would also like to state that the views expressed on this program are those of myself and of my guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the KHEN staff, volunteers, or board of directors. And my special guest this evening is Clifford Carnicom, and he's a self-employed professional computer consultant in Santa Fe, New Mexico. And he is also the founder and president of the Carnicom Institute, a nonprofit research and educational organization that is devoted to environmental and health issues. Clifford has also worked as a technical research scientist, acting in a professional capacity supporting analysis and development of major Department of Defense physical and weapons modeling systems with extensive computer programming and system application development experience. And he's held a top secret SCI clearance. He was appointed for and completed 2 years of intensive graduate level studies in mathematics, statistics, computer science, and geodesy under the auspices of the Department of Defense. He has been a federal employee of the United States government for 15 years within three agencies, including the Department of Defense, the Bureau of Land Management, and the United States Forest Service. And he has a Bachelor of Science cum laude degree and that was attained in the field of surveying and photogrammetry from the Civil Engineering Department of California State University of Fresno, California, and his postgraduate studies were conducted at the Ohio State University and Washington University. And he also possesses an Associate of Science degree and a Forest Engineering Vocational degree from the College of Redwoods at Eureka, California. And if there's anything more you'd like to add, Clifford, please do so.
No, that's fine, Melody. That's fine.
Well, I want to welcome you because I had the great experience of getting to go to one of your recent seminars, and I have been covering a little bit of the geoengineering and effects around geoengineering and aerosols, as you call them, or some call them chemtrails, but I think. You are the most, I would say that you would be able to cover that better than I can, so I'm going to just kind of turn it over to you here, so.
Well, thank you very much, Melody, and thank you for the opportunity to be here tonight. I appreciate it very much. And, I suppose we have a lot of ground that we could cover, so we probably want to organize our information in some way. In the recent conference that was held in Santa Fe in October, we had 2 days of pretty much solid work, and actually even that was only an introduction to the material. But the way I broke that up was to have a discussion of the environmental aspects of the work and then the biological aspects of the work. And with our time that we have, we could make that type of separation introduction, I suppose, because they are equally significant aspects of the work. There's roughly about 13, 14 years now, getting close to, of research work that's been done. And probably in general, the first half of that work for 6, 8 years or so was focused on environmental aspects. And then the latter several years have focused on biological aspects. However, and a very important point to be made, as we did during the recent conference, is that these areas overlap tremendously, and there is no real separation between them. It's simply I have to choose where to spend my time, and the environmental work was done, is in place, and from my perspective still stands and holds with respect to all of the findings. And there's actually a tremendous need to even recall and revisit most of that work because it's still ongoing as an active issue, almost everything that was found.
Well, can I ask you, what got you interested in this? Because it doesn't necessarily appear that you would have, this would have been a normal area for you to do your research in, or did I miss something?
Well, you know, what's my life was, I think two things probably characterized my life in terms of professional and academic environment. You know, and the first is that I have a strong basis in the outdoor and a natural life in my past. I spent from the time I was probably 12 years old, I remember, you know, going out and camping was a real important effect upon me in my life and development philosophy and this type of thing. And that carried on into the beginnings of my professional career. And at the same time, I have always had a very strong interest in science. And yet, by the same token, I have maintained an interest in really many disciplines in my life. And as the fact, the older I get, the broader that spectrum becomes, to where I would say there's few subjects or areas of endeavor that wouldn't interest me in some way and that I do not see some type of relationship between. So, you know, with that background, the academic background is fairly broad. You know, I started out in the arts and then I went into the sciences and then I went into engineering aspects. And then I went into undergraduate work was in surveying and photogrammetry. And that is a wonderful combination, actually, of both the natural world as well as the academic and technical world. And then eventually I went into geophysical work with the Department of Defense involving gravity field modeling, this type of thing. So actually, you know, I don't consider myself immune to basically any field of study. And in beginning of 1999, it was clear to me that our natural world was being altered, basically altered with the use of technology. And specifically, it started out with simply meteorological observations and operations involving aircraft that were clear to me were changing our environment. And we find in the end that it has changed it, and at this point, a permanent way, and that process, once it started, has never ceased to this day. And so there was a recognition that there was basically a crime, is what I would call it, a crime that was taking place, was a breach and an incursion upon basically the God-given rights of human beings and every form of life on this planet. And so my job was to call attention to those wrongdoings and the methods that I had available, also an interest in technology, you know, and computers were a part of my work. And when I left federal service, that's the civilian area that I was able to establish a basis for myself. So, you know, that was a point of never turning back, I suppose, in early 1999. And not that the offense actually starts in 99. There is a history that will go back to right after the close of World War II that will show such technology being used, meaning the alteration of our environment in both a physical as well as a biological sense, to produce, you know, who knows what basically, but to bring about certain effects upon the environment and in our case specifically the health and well-being of human beings as well as all life forms.
And so ultimately what you were, was it just looking up in the sky, noticing some things taking place, or was there some other events that really grabbed you to start looking at this issue?
Well, it starts with that. It starts with that in the sense that if, you know, if you have some awareness of your outdoor environment and the absolute crucial link in our life form and energy with the outdoor world, if you see that being changed, then visibly, in this case, the first photographs that I put up on the site were on Valentine's Day in 1999, and it was strictly a visual record and observation that something is different this time. I had been subconsciously, I think, becoming aware of it for several weeks, to a month or so before. But it was a point of recognition. I took those photographs. They span a period of roughly 20 minutes to show the progression, and that's what was important there, that in roughly 20 minutes of time, you had a complete transformation of the sky starting to take place, visibly take place, in the high desert regions of the southwestern United States, which are known for their clarity of skies and tremendous vistas and panoramas, and is a good part of the motivation as to why a lot of artists moved here, Taos and Santa Fe, dating all the way back to the 70s because of the spectacular scenery. And to see that environment altered literally within an hour's time, where there was no meteorological basis for that whatsoever. The climate in this region, historically at least, has been relatively stable, at least with respect to clarity of the atmosphere and visibility and that type of thing. So after you have a visual recognition, then you start seeing the effects of that over the ensuing years. And the most obvious apparent effect of that was with visibility, quality of the air. And it has reached a point where, you know, I would take a trip down to Albuquerque 50 miles away. Actually, we lived on the southern part of Santa Fe, a place called Lamy, and there's a mountain range roughly 10 to 15 miles away from there. It got to the point where the mountain ranges at very close range were visibly being affected in terms of just plain being able to see. And it actually reached the point. There were times when I had a mountain basically a half mile alongside of me where you could see. You could literally see the particulate matter and the haze at ground level that had developed from the introduction of these particulates, extremely fine particulates, and visibility. There's direct relationships between color and size of materials. What they call, you know, the Blue Ridge Mountains, that has to do with the air quality back there, where if the size of the particles is small enough, it'll create a slight bluish tinge to the haze in the atmosphere. So you started to have this effect basically broad-based, eventually across the country in large scale. You had the visibility standards being changed suddenly from 40 miles down to 10 miles with no adequate explanation whatsoever. So you have this, you know, first level would be documentation and just observing what's going on. The second is one can start to see the effects of this in really a simple and straightforward fashion. These are not the more complex or advanced issues that we're speaking of now, because it takes time to reach those, you know, to get into that discussion. But the next level of logical progression in a person, at least my person, my individual thinking about this, would be one would then start to wonder, what are the effects of this? What is the constitution of this material and change? What's it made of? And then, what is its effect? What is its effect upon the planet as well as human health? And I really do not think, just in terms of human health, it seems to me this is one of our shortcomings as a species. We have a tremendous interest when it has to do with our own individual health as a species. But I do believe that that same care and concern and love, actually, should be expressed towards the care and a guardianship of the entire planet and all life forms, not just human beings, because there is an interrelationship between all of them. So, you know, that's the next level just on the physical side of examining the problem in
okay.
terms of looking
Clifford,
at these things.
Can I just mention that you're I'm speaking with Clifford Carnicom, and your website is carnicom.com. Com, is that and I'm correct? Is it
yes, it's actually everything is being redirected, Melody, to this point, to the nonprofit, which is carnicominstitute.org.
Oh, okay.
You can go to either place. The original research work was and has been at carnicom.com, C-A-R-N-I-C-O-M, as in Mary, carnicom.com. But the site is all in the process of being redirected towards the nonprofit, which is carnicominstitute.org. And there is a body of work there now that is – spanning 14 years, which now has roughly whatever it is, the exact number, but roughly 250 papers that I have written over the 14 years that are available on that site. that cover the expanse of our introduction that we're going to have tonight.
Okay, great. Go ahead and just evolve into the next step that you were getting into here.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Melody. So, you know, in terms of the progression of the work, you know, you're now at the point where you see something, and then you're starting to examine its, or at least think about what are the effects upon the earth and those that dwell upon it. And so there is another stage of work that develops, which starts to work with the need for environmental analysis. If you think something's there, then the logical thing to do is to start testing it. And by the way, the logical thing to do is start testing it if nobody that is supposed to test it will do their job, is what it amounts to. Okay.
Right.
There were plenty of people at this stage. You know, there is an awareness without any question of millions of people across the world on this issue. That's been a slow evolution, but the fact is it's there. This is not a marginal or fringe topic that we are speaking of. It is the subject of deliberate and systematic alteration of our planet using technology. Aircraft are specifically involved. It's actually a very sensible way of dispersing materials. It's been done since, like I say, close of World War II. There is nothing that we cannot be immune from breathing. No matter what you do, it's about, you can ask whatever you need, a whole hierarchy of needs. You're not going anywhere without air, and you're not going anywhere very far. So when your atmosphere has been affected, it even precedes that of water and food and the whole chain after it. So if let's just say there was an awareness that had developed after a couple years on a broad scale, you had conservatively, easily thousands of people writing to their political officials requesting an investigation in a very fair-minded way, I would say. That record is all entirely there. People were asking for the environmental and governmental agencies to do their job, and that is, what the heck is going on with this environment? You can ask that question just from the pollution laws alone. If you look at the record, the quality of air in this country was improving. That's what the EPA laws were all about. We were improving in this country, in the world in general, in terms of, not in China, I don't suppose, but in this country, we certainly were improving in terms of our air quality. Now, if that suddenly degrades, it sort of negates the success and value of those laws that took decades to manifest and with the EPA and clean air laws. So people were legitimately asking for an investigation as to what the heck is going on with our air, simple as that. And they were essentially denied and refused and marginalized, and I would say attempted to be marginalized. And their heeds were not taken up by those that were responsible for acting in their interest. You know, the government that we have is a representation of the public. It's not an ordaining body that is to serve, have the people serve it. It's to serve the people. And these folks simply did not do their job. It's that simple. And had they done their job, I would not have been involved in several years of my life acting in the environmental sampling mode in a manner that I should never have to be doing, with extremely limited resources, not having access to the sampling process and environmental samples in a way that are smart. And the fact is, no citizen should be having to do this work. But I simply did the best I could under the circumstances because of the need. The need is there. If you have, you know, scores of letters. They're on my site. There is a page called Official Responses. It's a record. It's a record of the political and official responses to people reasonably asking for an investigation. Never happens. So that's what I have to do. And for several years, I get involved with environmental sampling. And there's probably there's probably at least 36 methods that are involved there, of methods of looking at what's in the air. Simple examples would be, you know, collection of rainwater to start with, and concentrating and distilling that collection, and then starting to examine its nature. First, always visibly first under a microscope, and then you would start to look at it chemically the best you can. Again, there's a right way to do this work. That was never done. I've done the best I could, which I think shows, you know, stands for itself. And I wouldn't retract a single thing that I put up on the site. If I did, it would be off the site. All of those tests are all there. Second level would be the use of HEPA filters, very fine filters that are very accessible to us now, and you can collect materials down to submicron level in the atmosphere. So those are used. And, of course, I am limited. I'm limited by being at ground level. You know, people often would make the statement or request, why the heck don't you just go take a plane up there and run a sample? Well, it's very easy for people to speak like that. But if you actually start looking at the logistics of that, it becomes, let's say, call it impractical at the least. Number one, you have expense issues. Number one, airspace above 18,000 or whatever is completely controlled. There's not a single aircraft up there where they don't know exactly what it is and where it is and what it's doing. In addition, it makes absolutely no sense to me to try to do things in a singular sense. I would never get involved with environmental sampling, taking a single sample and having it represent a global covert operation. You know, if you would ask me what I would do in terms of sampling, the very first thing I would do is I would collect every, let's say not, call it the, by the hundreds. I would collect hundreds of HEPA filters on every aircraft, a commercial aircraft flying at 35,000 feet or so. So you'd be dealing with sample sizes of hundreds over extended period of time, and you'd subject those HEPA filters to proper analysis. It'd be absolute folly to be, say, sending a single plane at a ridiculous expense. It's absolutely absurd, some of the things that are mentioned here. But I'm limited by being ground-based, and so I do the best I can. Another method would be what's called electrostatic precipitation. It's a fascinating method, actually. Has to do with I first ran into it through air cleaning for industrial plants. And the basic idea is injecting a high voltage into a chamber where the air is circulating. And it's fascinating to watch. If you were to put, like, some smoke inside of that chamber and subjected to this voltage, that smoke will immediately swirl around and collect on the outside or the inside of that glass chamber where it can be collected and sampled. There's 36 at least methods that were involved just on the simple elementary side of testing. pH testing actually had a national project there, had people involved from all over the country testing the pH of rainwater. Very interesting results. Also, it's an educational process for me entirely along the way every time. I think the lay level would think that, you know, the water should just be neutral. Rainwater should be neutral. pH is a measure of the acidity or alkalinity of a solution. And, you know, my first thinking is, oh, it's rain. It should be neutral. But as a matter of fact, rain is not neutral. It's slightly acidic by nature. The acidic rain is not entirely a man-made affair due to carbonic acid, the presence of CO2 in the atmosphere, will make it slightly acidic. And that might be what I have expected to see, something neutral. But in fact, the results came out on the alkaline side. And I think the factor was roughly 10-20 times greater. We could look at that paper. But basically, that work also showed that the rain on a national level appeared to be showing an increase in alkalinity. So we could cover those kinds of tests, you know, easily and take up our whole night. So I can't do that, but suffice it to say that that body of work is there. It gets involved with electromagnetics at a certain point, what's called ELF or BLF, radio waves. And ELF is, okay, let's back up a little bit. You have an electromagnetic spectrum. Many of us have heard of that. And radio waves and light and X-rays are a part of that spectrum and has to do with the length of the wave that puts it into a particular category. And there's a particular portion of that spectrum called the ELF spectrum, extremely low frequency, which is quite fascinating. And this is an area that has extremely long wavelengths. Literally, they're global. They're regional to global in extent. You know, think of a wavelength that's the length of the country. And actually, you can get to the point where that wavelength is literally the circumference of the Earth. So you're talking about very broad-based effects that could take place here when you're dealing with this section or segment of the electromagnetic spectrum. Well, there was work done which revealed, I suppose is the way to say it, revealed the presence and ambient, meaning surrounding and ongoing presence. That was never not found in the several years that I did that work, of ELF energy that was unexplained, totally unexplained to me. And the frequencies found started out with a frequency of 4 hertz, 4 hertz, 8 hertz, 12 hertz, but the fundamental frequency was 4 hertz. Now, this becomes absolutely fascinating because this is not something that is to be in the natural world. There is no known source of a frequency at that level that you would be able to detect that I'm aware of. And the reason I say that is because the lowest frequency that is would be expected from a physical basis is what's called the Schumann resonance. And the Schumann resonance is literally the resonant frequency of the Earth, and it has to do literally with the size of the Earth. That's what governs it. Frequency is largely and often governed by the size of the object that you're talking about. And the Earth has a size, and it has a frequency that basically is resonant with that, and it's called the Schumann resonance. So this is the biggest thing there is on this planet, the longest, largest body, and therefore the lowest frequency or longest wavelength. They would be equivalent to one another, and this would be 8 hertz. So here I am finding something at 4 hertz. Now, I have no physical basis for that whatsoever, and there is a logical question that needs to be asked is what is the source of that energy? Where does it come from and why is it there? And you also had what would be called harmonics of that, 4, 8, 12, 16 hertz, this type of thing, multiples of it. You know, many of us would be aware of like the 60 hertz signal for our electromagnetic grid, that type of thing. And it's also very hard, by the way, to measure this type of thing that I'm talking about. I spent a couple years developing circuitry and this type of thing for it. But here's the rub on this. Not only is it significant to understand what it is or where it's coming from and why it's there, but there is a relationship with the human being that we need to become aware of. And that is that our bodies and our mind, our brain, is also an electromagnetic system in its own right. There is a book called The Body Electric that people might be familiar with by Becker, I think Robert Becker, I think was his name. Our bodies are electromagnetic systems. And it is the case that the frequencies and the range that our body works in is that ELF spectrum. In other words, our brain works, electromagnetically works in the range of roughly, 0 to 100 hertz. Exactly what is the ELF or extremely low frequency portion of the spectrum? This raises some very serious questions because if you have a perpetuating source of unexplained ELF energy measured over a period of years repeatedly, and that energy range corresponds exactly with the functioning of the human brain and biological system in general, you've got a problem. You've got a problem that at least is worthy examination, right? I'm too diplomatic always the way I talk, but you've got a serious problem.
Okay,
right?
Well, let me go ahead and say this. I've got Clifford Carnicom, who is my guest this evening, and he's getting into his research around the aerosol spraying and the other aspects that are involved with what's going on in our skies and what's coming out of those skies. So go ahead, Clifford.
Thank you very much, Melody. So that opened up another Pandora's box here in terms of electromagnetics. And then that eventually will lead itself into an area called HARP. Now, what's interesting to me in my work is that I don't know where the research is going. I know before I did my work on electromagnetics that there were people that were inferring that we might have systems affecting us from a biological side, the issues of mind control, mind influence, that type of thing. And by the way, these things are not fantasies, folks. There's a history and record of programs like this. Again, since human beings have been able to do things, they'll do it. And if they can imagine doing something, they will do it. So these things are not imaginative.
I agree with that one.
All right. And but nevertheless, there were people saying such things, but I really had no basis for it. And there's a lot of talk on the net and the general global community. People talk all the time, but it's not the way that I work. It's not the way that a person can make a rational case to basically motivate and cause people to congregate and support any particular cause to make this world a better place. So I do my work in my style. What's interesting on the HARP inclusion was that my work never considered that ahead of time. What happened was I literally start measuring. You know, in other words, the question was raised. People say maybe there's something going on. So I can't act upon that. So I have to spend 2 years of my life trying to learn how to basically design a circuit to measure ELF energy. It's sort of a hard thing to do. So a couple years is put into that because I need a device to measure this because I don't have the answers. I don't have the direct results from anyone. So I do it, and the work says I find it, right? Well, when you look at the result that, okay, now you have something that you can say I'm measuring it. It's there. There is a logical probing and extension that takes place into the subject of HARP technology. And it happened actually after the fact. I did not know that the work would lead there. But if you look at what I'm talking about finding this energy, and you start asking where does it come from and what would be its effect, you will be led to HARP technology. Now, HARP stands for, I think it's High Active Auroral Research Program. It is a facility up in up in Alaska, and it's in Alaska for a very specific reason. If you look at the general blueprint of that expressed in a patent by Bernard Eastland in 1987, we can talk about these things. They're fascinating. I'll have to just abbreviate it, but there's a reason it's up in Alaska, and it has to do with the magnetic field and also an abundant source of cheap energy, namely oil. What I do is I start looking at this technology as expressed in this patent, and it's absolutely amazing. It started out very slow. When I first read the patent, it's pretty much Greek. I didn't exactly, it's a technical. It's a bit to take in. And, I read it, and then I go back and I read it. And then I start studying it. And it was absolutely astounding because many of the very same conclusions that I had come to over a period of many years through entirely independent research with no real, let's say, driving influence of somebody guiding that other than my own sense of intuition in place on research, I start finding pretty much an exact match between the conclusions I'm reaching, both in the physical side, I mean the actual constitution of the materials that I'm talking about. It's one thing to have something introduced into your air that you have to breathe. There's a mechanical aspect to that. You don't want to breathe particulate matter because more of us will die if we do. That's just a plain fact. That's a mechanical act. But the deeper question even underneath that is what is the material made of? And I was doing work to answer that question, and the conclusion I came to in general, that one of the dominant components physically that was being found were metallic salts. And not only that, a particular class of metallic salts. My work centers on what's called group 2 of the periodic table. Calcium, magnesium, barium, strontium, this type of thing. And my work showed the presence of these type of salts, basically metallic salts in the atmosphere. And my work showed the presence of this ELF energy. If you study the Hart pattern, you will find that these basically form the core of that technology. And that technology involves the use of basically an electrically charged atmosphere. Okay. Many of us are familiar with what's called the ionosphere. And this is, whatever it is, 60 to 120 miles or whatever it is roughly, a layer above the Earth that is an electrically charged layer. And it was the basis for the discovery of radio. Long-distance communications. The first radio signal was sent because of the presence of this layer, which allowed a radio wave to bounce off of it when somebody's over in Europe and the other person's over in the USA. So that launched radio, and the discovery of that layer of electrically charged material. And it's extremely important when you have an electrical property to a gas, which is what the atmosphere is. That layer up there changes everything about the dynamics of energy transfer. And if you look at the HARP patent and that idea, the extension of it is basically trying to take that ionosphere, what's happening in that ionosphere, which is a charged particles, ions is what they call it. Think of it as electrons flowing or floating around there. To increase that density of the general atmosphere, not just that layer. HARP starts out basically using the ionosphere as a place to start conducting experiments. But the actual logic of that patent says, what if we were to increase the electrical charge in the atmosphere in general? What could we do with it? And how would you do that, by the way? And you do it by introducing certain types of metallic salts into the atmosphere. And guess what one of those salts is? It's a barium salt. Barium is a absolute target candidate for examination here and all the work that's been done. I've spent quite a bit of time with it. Barium is a fascinating element because it has the property that element, when subjected to ultraviolet light, and the hint there is that ultraviolet light comes from sunlight, so I don't need an external power source. I get to use what's there in the cosmos. Have the introduction of this metallic salt into the atmosphere, and if you subject it to ultraviolet light, it will cause increased ionization, or therefore increased electron flow within the atmosphere. It's absolutely incredible when I first learned of this that you could actually have something that requires no external additional or human induced energy source, but that from the natural environment, and you would be able to basically capitalize on that energy source and then alter the electrical nature of the atmosphere from it. Once you do this, just as the ionosphere allows for a complete range of possibilities with respect to flow of energy, you now must extend that same thinking to include the entire atmosphere, not just this singular layer above the Earth isolated from us. And they call that state of affairs a plasma. A plasma is an electrically conductive gas. And the simplest example that I can present about what that means is that of a neon light tube. Many of us are familiar with the fluorescent light tube, and we have this tube with no wire in it. It's quite fascinating. There's no wire in that tube, and yet the darn thing lights up. And so how does that happen? What happens is you're sending energy through a gas that has free electrons in it, that has an electrical charge, and it causes it to light up. Now, start taking that thinking and start to extend your scale of thinking to imagine essentially the atmosphere as now, at least in part, successfully transformed as a plasma state. There's different states of plasma, and we're talking about what would be a very weak plasma. But nevertheless, increasing the electron density of a gas in a very small amount, it doesn't take much, it completely changes the electrical nature of that gas. And you must then start to ask, what would you do with that? If you were to actually generalize the alteration of the entire atmosphere of the planet such that it could propagate energy, what would you do with it? And again, human beings do anything they can get their mind wrapped around, and we tend to like to create weapons and things that destroy things in our world. And so weapons come to the forefront very quickly. And HAARP will speak of such applications, very much so on the military side, because once you have energy, human beings love to try and control it. And we, like I say, we tend to have a preoccupation with creating weapon systems and sense systems that can cause destruction. Seems to be the case more than constructive systems, if we would think of power and energy usage and this type of thing. So this is what HAARP talks about, and the overlap is actually incredible. The more that I looked at it, and I, from my standpoint, there's pretty much a one-to-one match between the technology described within that patent. And when you have a patent, it in some ways it's a misnomer to call it a HAARP patent, because a patent is just an idea. But in terms of the application, it certainly does look as though the HAARP facility is a manifestation of the technology expressed within that patent.
Okay, and I want to state that I've got Clifford Carnicom, whose website is the Carnicom Institute.com, right?
.org, Melody.
Oh, okay.
.org. We do have nonprofit status.
Okay, CarnicomInstitute.org, and then he also has a website, Carnicom.com, and that this has a lot of the information that you've been talking about this evening, and we're talking about geoengineering and aerosols and all the other aspects that are applied to this particular subject, and it's fascinating because you've done a lot of work with this. Go ahead.
Thank you very much, Melody. So that introduced that aspect of the work. And again, it's all still there. Several years of work were done investigating this electromagnetic issue. Scores of times hiking out or going out to the most remote parts I could find, because you don't want electromagnetic interference when you're doing this, and asking the question, what happens if I go out in the middle of a field and I can't find anything around for 30 miles, or I go on the top of a mountain as high as I can, what happens? And the results are quite consistent, and they are portrayed, as you say, within the site, within roughly the 250 papers that have accumulated over the years. Now, we were speaking of applications, and I suppose at some time I'll go through my list. I have a list of 7 application areas just to let people know that there's no – I'm not the soundbite person. I cannot give you a simple single answer to what's happening here. I can give you an analysis spanning 14 years involving 250 papers that covers seven major areas of endeavor, and each of these – areas can be talked about at length, and we would be here for several weeks, I'm sure. So we'll get the summary best I can, in the hour that we have. But before I finish, we'll make sure we go through that list. But I'll give an example of application of that altered electromagnetic atmospheric environment, namely called a plasma, that is mentioned in that patent. That just fascinates the heck out of me in terms of the scale of what can happen here, that all of us, I think, could remain essentially totally unaware and oblivious to that which could occur on a very grand scale, should there be adequate forces and design behind it. There is a mention in that patent of what's called a heave weapon. You know, the first time I saw it, I see this phrase and it says this technology could be used to create a heave weapon. And heave weapon, heave is in quotes, H-E-A-V-E, heave, in quotes. And I'm saying, what the heck is that? I've never heard of that. So I start, and in these patents, literally you have two or three sentences, and they're often very technical, and they're absolutely packed in terms of what they're actually trying to say if you'll study them. And I start asking what this is, and I start reading his two or three sentences at most that are given about this thing. And what he's describing, what Eastland is describing, is this system where you can accumulate energy, within the it's really within the magnetic field is what it is. But think of it being the atmosphere right now, because that would be the mechanism. Accumulate energy in the atmosphere and the magnetic field of the Earth, where you literally lift up the magnetic field of the Earth. I mean, I used to work in field study, you know, gravity field study, so I have a conceptual sense of what this thing is about, even though I can't see it. But if you could imagine a three-dimensional force field around you, okay, in this case a magnetic field versus a gravity field, imagine some system being able to lift up, literally like move, lift up that magnetic field and then slam it back down on the Earth. Imagine that on a scale on the size of the United States, something like that. And what he says is, if you could do this, that you could have the effect and impact of an atomic bomb without having a bomb. Okay. The energy that you're talking about would be equivalent to having an atomic bomb, but you'd have no bomb. This stuff is just astounding to me.
Now, is this something like Tesla work here that you're talking about with this? Is this something that he worked around or different?
As I have studied Tesla, you know, and picked up some of his books the best I can, he's an absolutely fascinating individual in his own right. But as I have studied him, I would say I could see no other than a direct parallel between the types of ideas and projects and inventions and creativity that Tesla had and those that are manifest within a patent and project such as HARP. There is, to me, a direct parallel between these. Tesla, if you look at Tesla, one of the things I was really struck by is he was very big into the use of resonance. And he had these things where you'd have a rod or something in the earth and you'd start hammering this thing, okay? And then you'd start hammering it at a particular frequency. And he was very involved. I'm not an expert on him by any chance, but I did get the gist of what I saw, what he was about. He was an incredible individual. But he was very knowledgeable of the power that is contained within the issue of what's called resonance, where if you do things at the right timing and sequence, then you can accumulate energy in a progressive sense. And the scale of that energy that you can accumulate can be quite large, can be huge actually, relative to the input, say, of an individual signal. An individual signal would mean nothing. But if you can do it at the right time and resonate, you can accumulate this energy to where you can do incredible things. And Tesla did many incredible things. And the whole story up in Colorado, right, there's all kinds of stories about him shutting down the power grids and this type of stuff, you know, with his inventions. And it's disturbing things on a grand scale that nobody had ever seen or heard of. Well, yes, it's exactly what I'm speaking of, because if you look at the Hart patent, you will find a direct reference to the basically the accumulation of ELF energy in a resonant sense to accumulate energy expressed in one example that I gave called a heave weapon, which literally has the ability to lift and slam down the magnetic field of the Earth in a way that would be equivalent to a detonation of atomic bombs in terms of energy.
Oh, how about with earthquakes or something along that line?
Would and this becomes conceptual. Again, I have to operate upon what I can imagine with my background and my knowledge. And I guess the first thing I would say is that ELF energy pretty much crosses all space and time. Nothing's going to stop it. One of the public known applications for ELF energy is in submarine communications, where when I first read about this, and I haven't been there, I haven't seen it, but I can imagine it. In the submarines, you'd actually have an antenna that's apparently can be miles long. Imagine dragging a wire underneath the ocean miles long behind a submarine. But apparently that's the gist of what it's about, because remember we were talking about very long wavelengths. So you'd want a long antenna if you can get it. ELF antennas by nature would be very long in general, unless you use a coil like I did. You have to try and – that's what coils are about. You try to shorten it up by putting it into a coil form. But ELF classic application is that of communications underneath the ocean where you can't go popping your head above and sticking out an antenna and use ELF energy to do it, because that type of electromagnetic wave will basically spread out and cover a very long, you know, large distance, because it's not bound by the inability to penetrate material such as very short wavelengths are. You know, higher short wavelengths will get to the point where they won't go through your skin. But so, you know, the answer to your question about can it be used is yes, because it would not stop there. It would literally be used to communicate with a submarine on some base and some monitoring station somewhere on the other side of the world, for that matter. So when you start asking the question about earthquakes, my answer is yes, that you would expect the application of the accumulation of energy that would affect not only the magnetic field of the Earth, but also the tectonic plates of the Earth. There'd be no reason in the world that you wouldn't think. They do mapping by tomography is a method by which you map the surface underneath the ground. And how do you do that? You do that by sending wavelengths that can penetrate the ground. That's for mapping. Now, human beings love weapons. Sorry. We have this fascination. And so we're not always mapping. We're doing anything we can get our hands on about creating systems to control things. So my answer is at a conceptual level, because I'm not directly involved in the field, but certainly you could get involved with the geologists alone and just talk to the oil exploration people about what they do and commercially publicly known methods of technology of penetrating the Earth and getting that energy down there underneath where you can't see. Again, just start thinking on a bigger scale. And can you tell me you could exclude the ability and desire to affect geological and tectonic plates?
Right. Now, to add that in with some biological forms, and that's what, you know, was another aspect of your seminar that was so interesting, because where would these two kind of intersect, and what were you finding?
It's a huge issue, Melody. And I guess what I'll do is I'll, in the time that we have, let me go ahead, if you're willing, to at least read the list so people know that there's more grounds for investigation, should they wish to.
Okay.
And then we'll spend a couple minutes on the biological side. Is that okay with you?
Great. Yes.
Yeah. So there's a list of seven areas. What I call them areas of endeavor. These, to me, are areas of endeavor, application areas, where the work shows that certain things could happen with all that has been studied over the 14 years. And the list is not intended to be exclusive. In other words, when I say one, it doesn't mean that's the only one. The list has expected overlap between any and all of them, and the list is not necessarily exhaustive. It is simply what I have accumulated over the past 14 years as being consistent with the data. And what it means is every one of these is consistent with all of the data and research that I have over the 14 years. And the list would be as follows. The first is that of environmental modification and control. This would be, you know, the weather control thing is in here. This is, many, many people are of the notion that that's enough to explain everything about what's going on here. To me, it's one of seven. Environmental modification control. Second would be biological operations. Third is electromagnetic applications. We've been able to hint on those today just a little bit. Fourth is military. We've hinted on a couple aspects of that. Fifth is planetary modification and control. We actually haven't done too bad in the time we had, because that planetary modification and control has to do with what Melody was just asking about on earthquakes and this type of thing. That's in that range, geophysical applications. The sixth one would be that of development of advanced surveillance systems. Again, a fascinating topic of discussion. And the seventh would be what I would the technical phrase is detection of ionic disturbances. That's a technical phrase. Propulsion, particularly in relation to exotic propulsion systems, and the common vernacular would be the detection of UFOs. The biological issue is a huge issue, and I'll try to, in the time we have, summarize it the best that I can. But when we go back to those early stages, and I'm literally speaking of 1999, where you have the process of strictly documenting what's going on, and then you have the environmental sampling process take place, even very early on in 1999, there was the visual identification of what I would call, the phrase is unusual biological components. That's the phrase that was used. Unusual biological components within environmental samples, particularly a filament sample. There is a filament sample of great interest that has developed here over the years. We've talked about it a fair amount at the conference. Our Environmental Protection Agency gets involved in this issue. In a mode of negligence, basically, which has never been addressed properly, as people will learn about this and we can get the legal representation that we need to investigate that properly. The EPA failed us in very significant ways. But within a certain class of environmental filament samples, there were biological components, call it cellular structures, however you want to think about this, biological organisms, that were observed. That's the beginning point. And this goes all the way back to 1999. Now, that issue never left. My work focused generally on the environmental side for those first 8 years. But if you look at that work, you will also see from the very beginning, there was the reporting of an aspect of a biological nature that was, first of all, difficult to believe, very hard for people to accept, and generally the issue was denied and not at all given the attention that it required and still requires. That issue over the years has only increased in its seriousness and complexity with respect to these operations that we're speaking of. Now, why was it hard to believe? First of all, if you start looking at those papers, they show the repeated detection of a structure which, by, again, still remains by the best analysis available. This includes everything that I can do within my means. It actually does involve a medical professional early in the game that you will see that made his conclusions about what was going on. But the work still stands, and it involves the repeated detection of what appears to be a desiccated erythrocyte form. Now, an erythrocyte is a red blood cell. Desiccation would means drying, and the lay term for this would be a freeze-dried blood cell. Okay? Now, that's very uncomfortable for many of us to consider such a prospect. And it wasn't pleasant for me to have to present these papers because I knew they would be controversial, but those are not the standards that I use to do my work. The work is what needs to be done regardless of where that led. And this was a very difficult and unpopular area over the years of imagining the prospect that there might be such a type of structure involved in atmospheric testing. However, if you actually will go look at the history, and I made reference to this document during the conference, but there is a document by the U.S. Government Printing Office in 1977 involving congressional hearings, and the title of that paper, just as a lead-in, is called Biological Testing Involving Human Subjects by the Department of Defense, 1977. Subtitle, Examination of Serious Deficiencies in the Defense Department's Efforts to Protect the Human Subjects of Drug Research. Again, not folly that we're speaking of, by the way. There is a record there easily going back to the 1950s showing indeed that biological operations have been conducted upon an unsuspecting public for decades. What's different here, what appears to be different here, is the scale of the operation as well as the dire nature of the consequences of what appears to be essentially global effects. This is not something we're talking about within a few people. And so that work is there, and it stands after these years. It still stands. There is also a tremendous amount of attention given to that particular filament structure that I referenced that the EPA refused to identify when they were asked to do so in a polite but assertive manner, where they did not acknowledge the request, they did not acknowledge the request for identification. They simply said they had no awareness of an issue, and they did not acknowledge the existence of a physical sample, which to this day remains absolutely paramount to our understanding of the consequences of these biological operations upon us. As a matter of fact, the Institute is just in the process now of trying to get some systematic collection of that material, since the incidence of reporting appears to be increasing lately. But it's still totally unanswered. The same problems of imagine a citizen or citizens trying to do the work of what literally would require millions of dollars of proper facilities, equipment, and staff. And it's exactly what our governmental agencies are for. It's exactly what we have paid for and why we have created such agencies. And imagine them failing in a dismal sense, and then imagine grassroots organizations trying to do things out of a shoestring box to get answers to basically problems involving biotechnology and genetic engineering and advanced weapon systems and this type of thing. It's absurd, I'm sorry to say, the state of affairs that we are in. But this is a state of affairs we're in, and I've done and I'm doing the best I can. Again, I have to make a living best I can. That's what I have to do with my time. And I've created a nonprofit as a vehicle to at least make my mark the best that I can to let people know that these issues are real. The state of affairs in this world are now such that it's easier for many of us to accept the fact that we have been screwed over in many ways, And this is simply one set of consequences that have been inflicted upon this planet and the human race and all life that dwells upon it, which if someone would care to apply themselves to it, I think that you would actually have a difficult time denying the reality if you actually were willing to put forth that effort.
Clifford, let me just say this is KHENLP 106.9 Salida, and I just want to mention that, okay, what you're getting into is a type of life form that you were able to identify in these desiccated blood red cell samples. But one of the things that you brought out in this conference that I was gleaning from it is that you were able to reproduce them inside these cells, and they were quite small, but at the same time, you were also able to state that these crossed over between species and the like, right?
It gets, you know, science fiction is no longer science fiction, is what it appears. I do think of the human mind and how we are as a species, and we love to get our fingers in anything we can get our fingers in, whether we're qualified or not to be there. And, you know, nuclear power is certainly one of those examples where we realize we got a little bit more than we bargained for. And the field of biotechnology is a similar area of investigation and creativity going on with the human species that is not exactly necessarily under our complete control in the way that we might hope or wish that it is. Now, you're right, and I can jump to that if you'd like. Now, there's quite a bit of ground we could cover before that in terms of identification of the particular life form and characteristics of it and that type of thing. We could do that, and that would be fine. But let's go ahead and take your point. And then, you know, people can work backwards if they would like to. But here's the problem that came up. Imagine somebody seeing something. They see an organism, and they don't know what it is. They don't have the knowledge or background to know every single organism that there is by any means. My understanding is that our knowledge of the microbial world is essentially a joke in terms of the percentage of what we know versus what we know is there in terms of categorization and identification. We don't know but a fraction of the life forms that are even there. So I do not claim to have that extensive library, which even the world does not have at this point in my head. But let's say you find something that catches your interest, and yet not only that, you find such a organism within a very peculiar filament structure that is airborne when it is collected. So basically you have a containing structure with disparate life forms. In other words, you would not expect to find a bacterial form contained within a filament in an airborne form. You have a conflict in terms of just morphology and mechanics there. It doesn't make a whole lot of sense. But anyway, let's say you found something that you don't know what it is. And so you start raising questions, and I do it publicly on a net, and I say, this is what I see. And I'll put out the question from day one. If you know what it is, tell us. If you've got the means to help us identify it, help us. But here it is, and this is what I'm seeing. And so this was done, and this has been done now for 10, 12, 14 years, and the questions have not been answered any more than they were 12 years ago. And all of the identifying characteristics of that organism and its combination with the filament structure have been described in extensive detail with years of work. And so this still exists, and after 12 years, you'll see a paper probably, I think it was at maybe it was about June, I don't know, but it was only a few months ago, you'll see a paper that I put up, and the paper is called The Breath of a Decade. And that paper is probably representative of my frustration that after 12 years of calling attention to the very same thing, the same forms, that 12 years later I receive a sample that is exactly like that one that I sent to the EPA, and we know no more than we knew 12 years other than the work that I'm able to do and or others. I will give credit to anybody that works in a constructive way on these issues, and it's not just me. But in terms of what I can describe, we're no better off than what I'm able to provide over 12 years of work. Completely and totally unacceptable. But that is the case. Now, imagine you can't identify it, which is where we're still at, and then you start doing your best to identify it because nobody else will. And you start studying biology and microbiology, and you start learning about the classification of life itself on this planet. This is what it came down to. And when I grew up in school, you know, you had these things called the animal kingdom and the plant kingdom, and there were like six or kingdoms or whatever it is, six or eight kingdoms, and we had these kingdoms of life. And then my schooling was a bit back there. I'm 58 years old now. And so I have to refresh and renew myself along the way with this work on a continuous basis. And I start looking at what's happened in biology. And in the 70s or so, I think it was in the late 70s, you had a very interesting change take place that I hadn't heard about when I went to school. And that was that life had been reclassified. And that reclassification is now accepted by many, many people as being more accurately representing the structure of life on this planet. And I think the guy's name, I don't want to mispronounce it here. It starts with W, maybe it's Wise. We'll find it. That paper on the site is called, I think it's called A New Classification, if I remember. Yeah, I think that's the title of my paper, A New Classification. But if you read this guy, what he did was he sort of started fresh. I saw a PBS series just a few weeks ago on this, which is fascinating to see them talk about this guy, because I encountered a paper about it and realized the significance of what he had done. On his own, he just sort of opens it up from scratch and says, what's really driving the categorization of life? And is it really right to use these six kingdoms? So what he does is he figures out that a more logical way to characterize and organize life is in the genetic nature of life, not by how it looks to us, not by whether it looks like it's a plant or a bug, but the genetic constitution and origin of that life. That's what he does. And he gets to the point where he takes all life on the planet, no matter what it is, and he is able to break all life on this planet into three categories rather than six or eight kingdoms. And these two systems are so opposed to one another that it's sort of like a joke to me to compare them, because they're totally different. Because there was no basis of genetics in the original stuff. We did it more by morphology and by, you know, bacteria versus let's just say a plant and an animal. Sure, that's a classic one, right? The plant and the animal kingdom. Because we do it by looks and what we think is a sensible structure. But if you look at this fellow who I keep calling Wise, I'm sure that's not exactly right. We could find it. But this guy comes up with three classes of life. And the three classes of life are, one of them will be in the bacterial world. Many of us have a sense about that one, the bacterial world. And then there'll be a category called the eukaryotes. And the eukaryotes, it has to do, it's almost, what you can almost think of as everything else that we're familiar with. Plants, animals, it's all there. Anything basically with a nucleus in the cell. So plants and animals are essentially of the same stock when it comes to examination of their genetic origins. And it's fascinating, this documentary that I just watched, the degree of separation between us and all the life forms that we generally are familiar with, including plants, is much, much smaller than most of us would ever care to realize, including microbial forms, by the way. Okay. So those are two, though. And this encompasses most everything that we are aware of. And then there's a third category. And the third category is called the archaea. And I see we're going over a little bit, and I hope that's okay with you, Melody.
That's
is that
fine.
True?
That's totally fine, yes.
All right. So there's a third category called the archaea. And this is, I call it a new category. it's new to us. It's actually been around since the origin of the planet. So it's just a matter of human beings getting on board to figure out something that happened 4.5 billion years ago. But the archaea, the easiest way to describe this is imagine taking a trip to Yellowstone. I hope many of you have been able to do that in your life. But you see all those bubbling pools and geysers and all that kind of stuff as you're driving through. And those kind of things that seem, my goodness, those certainly are hostile. Those certainly are hot. I'm sure there's certainly no fish swimming around in there. Well, guess what? Those things are full of life. And this is what's been learned. I think it started in the 70s. And I think the volcanic vents in the ocean, they would find where volcanoes are releasing, you know, their steam and their hot gases, what we consider to be poison. And they'd find these vents under at the bottom of the ocean. And they'd start examining these things. And then they find out that there's life forms there. And when I grew up in school, I remember the day that instructor said, all life comes from the sun. You know, this is the way it is. Well, sorry, it's not true. It's been learned that there are chemical environments that are sufficient to support life. As a matter of fact, it looks like that's certainly how life originated is its own term too. That's another issue. But nevertheless, it existed in an early form on this planet. Was in a chemically based environment as much or more than anything related to solar energy. So now start imagining all those very hostile environments that you could never imagine anything living. Guess what? There's something living in all of them. Every place that we can imagine and see, there is life existing. And you will get to arguments and discussions involving life outside this planet very quickly. There's fascinating topics about that. Basically, we can't get rid of it no matter where we look is what's going on. So this is another category of life. And what characterized that form of life was its existence in environments that are considered extremely hostile and impossible by our common notions to ever have emerged in or existed in. And the fact is it's there. Now, the importance of this issue is that as I step back and I look at the characteristics of this organism, this life form that we're talking about, it's very specific. We could go over it in details. Basically, a heart of it would be a submicron, or it would appear to be what looks like a bacterial form, about roughly best size estimate is about 0.4 of a micron right now. This would be a core constituent of what we're speaking of. But as I step back and I look at the characteristics of what I see, in other words, what kind of environments can it live in? What does it exhibit in terms of potential genetic constitution?
Clifford, let me just state, this is Clifford Carnicom that I'm speaking to, and he's my guest this evening, and he's getting into some really interesting aspects of his research around geoengineering and the biologicals that he has found in the aerosols and the like that have been coming out of our skies. So go ahead.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Melody. As I step back and I look at this and I ask the question, we've got the best minds in the world that have settled on the structure that says there are three categories of life. So this means if we have any life form, we're supposed to be able to take it and put it in one of these three categories. And so I look at what I'm studying and I'm saying, okay, which category is it in? And I go through these three categories and what it is that defines them. And I find that I can't place it in any single one of them. But guess what I am able to do? The best that I can do with what I look at, I'm able to put it in all three of them. And this doesn't fit. If what I'm saying is correct, it doesn't even fit known, established, accepted biological definition of life as we know it.
That opens up a whole new can of worms.
It sure does. And that's what that paper is about. This paper called A New Classification was this recognition by myself after looking at this for many years that even when I try in the most broad sense that I can to categorize what I'm seeing here, I can't get it to fit within the single one, but I can get it to fit in actually all three of them, which supposedly is impossible. And remember, this is all happening at the grassroots level, folks, right? Without the right equipment, all that, which I can say for ad nauseum in terms of what's really the right way to get these questions answered. But this is what I'm able to do from my side, and it's what I offer, and I don't claim anything is the truth. I simply lay it out as I see it, and we all get to decide what we think is true. But this is what I find. And then the point of that article is therefore to ask, how could this be? If this is true, how could this be? And my answer to that, again, has to do with the creativity of human beings and what they will do if they get their hands on something. And if you start to learn, which I am to some degree, about genetic engineering and what they call biotechnology, we're in a whole new ballgame right now, even in the conventional world. Okay, we showed it at the conference, okay, but in the conventional world, you're putting a cow's hide on a sheep, okay? This is what we're doing. We're mixing and matching every way we can get our hands on it. And there are some things that are known. There's a whole world going on that we have no idea what's going on with respect to bioengineering and genetic engineering and genetically modified organisms. But I will say this from what I see. I can imagine that if human beings have an understanding and a grasp that there are now three primary lines of biological existence on this earth that exist, that if I now start to use the knowledge that I have acquired from biotechnology and experimenting and playing around, and I get to mix things up to see what happens, and I get to put the fish in the tomato or whatever it is that I'm doing. And I understand human beings, you know, inherent curiosity. I understand it. But, you know, there are consequences to what we do. But I can easily imagine some, let's say, call it a body or a mindset, having this knowledge, deep-seated knowledge of all the inner details of the structure of life in this threefold fashion. And then I can take the mindset of the person that says, now that we know this, what could we do with it? And it is not even a slight stretch to me to say, I wonder if we could cross over between the two of these three branches of life. Could I actually take something from the bacterial world genetically, and could I cross it over with something in the eukaryote world? Could I do such a thing? And I can only say I cannot imagine that human beings have not asked that question, and that the work indicates that these lines may indeed have been crossed, and they may have been crossed in a way that is affecting all of us in ways that we have no knowledge of unless we're willing to discuss this further.
Well, one of the things that struck me is it appears that this freeze-dried erythrocyte may have been the medium to grow this life form, and yet now you've discovered that once it's out in the world, it can now expand out in many other ways. You were able to grow it in other ways, right?
Well, I've been working, you know, one of my goals as time went on was to ask, is it possible to culture this thing? That's been a huge part of the work, in that, you know, the classic scientific method is to always try to control everything, right? It's what they want to do. I mean, I have that background and it's fine, but human beings think they have the means to control everything or want to control everything. And so we play that game best we can, but just understand we don't know everything, folks, but it's a very logical thing to apply the scientific methods in the best way that you can, so that people at least have some reference frame about how they can understand things. But science is, by its very nature, is extremely limited. As much as I've spent a good part of my life in it, it is very limited, because one of the fundamental tenets of scientific method is you need to be able to observe it. You need to be able to see it. And that's a joke in itself, because we see one little slit out of this electromagnetic spectrum alone. And to base our entire reality of understanding in this world about a little slit that we happen to be able to see is sort of ridiculous. But nevertheless, it's what we do. So, you know, you're bringing up the issue of now studying in the scientific method, which I obviously do. I mean, I apply myself as much as I can to that. But it also raises a lot of questions. But one of the logical things to do, if you identify some kind of organism, you want to see if you can culture that. You want to see if you can get in a controlled environment. Because our bodies are not the place to be playing around, folks. And there are people doing that because people do not have the knowledge or assistance or help that they need to actually get useful and reliable information about what's going on in our bodies. They have to do the best they can. And a lot of times, that involves sheer experimentation by people trying things, sometimes out of desperation. And it's not the way medicine is supposed to work, and it's another huge failing of our system here, in that you have something that, by all rights, is affecting a significant part, if not all, and I can't hide that phrase, if not all, or essentially all of the population of this planet, and we do not have any real medical or scientific investigation of that. So I do the best I can, and you ask the question, can I culture it? And that work has been successful, is what I can say. And how would I say this? Remember how we talked about how this thing is crossing over between these three lines of life, at least appears to be?
Right.
Well, imagine something being able to live in the chemical soup of Yellowstone, as well as manifest characteristics of the, quote, most complex or more complex form of life involving red blood cells. This is a crazy crossover, folks. Well, if it can do these things, as I'm saying and showing that it is, then what it's really saying is you can't get rid of it. It's not a matter of trying to find a place where you can find it. It's a matter of you can't get rid of it. And so culturing this has not, in the end, turned out to be a difficult affair. And it appears that it can actually exist in many different types of environments. So far, there's nothing known that I can see at my level that would, quote, kill it. I have 10-year-old samples that I believe I can take a drop out of that extract and put it into a new culture and start a whole thing 10 years later without any blink of the eye. So yes, that process of culturing has been successful, and there has been a significant body of knowledge that has been gained from that culturing process. However, it is still in its infancy in terms of what actually needs to be done. And the environment for these studies, you know, if I get to make a plug for the nonprofit, it's that a place is needed, facilities are needed, equipment is needed, staff is needed to conduct serious level scientific work and public advocacy work around these issues.
Okay, so what you're saying is you've got an organism now that you're finding in the environment that didn't used to be recognized, and that it's invasive, and that you're also finding that within the red blood cell that it could literally take over human ability to utilize oxygen, right?
You're correct. Thank you for taking the time to read the papers and listen. I appreciate it. There's a paper that I finished last month. I don't write – well, how would I say it? It gets harder and harder for me to write these papers because they just take time. I need to make a living. This last one, I don't know if I can do this again. I have 5 papers on tap right now that I'm supposed to be writing. I just can't keep up with them. But the one that you're speaking of, it's a sort of milestone in terms of consolidation of information. And this paper was finished in the middle of October. There's about 7 months of time invested in this one paper. It's probably the longest one I've written. It's about 30-some pages, I guess. It's called Mergellin's thesis is the name of it. And this paper has about 7 months of combined research as well as writing to produce it. Now, that's because, you know, I do it when I can, whenever I can, fill it in. Maybe it wouldn't take as long if we could get our act together in terms of getting the right resources on things. But this paper is a consolidation of a great deal of research that makes the case. Again, everybody can decide for themselves, but it makes the case based upon the application of scientific methods and principles that a primary consequence of the existence of this particular organism within the body, and by the way, it's not necessarily just human, the human body. I actually have some, I did one paper on animals a couple years ago. I actually have some blood samples from animals that I need to be looking at, tell you the truth, right now. Don't restrict our discussion necessarily to the human species. But a primary consequence of the existence of this organism appears to be, my language is always too kind, but appears to be the alteration and modification of the state of iron. By state, I mean the chemical state. The chemical state of the iron within our body, specifically within the blood. Now, go back on that just a little bit. I won't go into all the details of it, but we do have iron in our body. And iron is one of the most, you know, as I'm studying this stuff, it's like everything is crucial. You think something's important and it is important. It's like the next thing I go to, they're all important. So you can have these statements and I'll say them, but there's like, I have 1,000 of them right behind it. But it's a fair statement to say that iron, the role of iron is probably one of the most important and influential mechanisms of our body and our metabolism. It's huge. Okay. And a very simple one is the understanding of its relationship to oxygen, because we breathe, we exist, we live because of iron and many, many other things, by the way, folks, which I'm learning. But you're not going anywhere, just as you weren't going anywhere without breathing air. You're not going anywhere without iron, because iron binds to oxygen in our body. It is the transport mechanism for oxygen in our body. And in my studies, which have been real heavy on chemistry and biology and biochemistry lately, it's my field over the last 6 months to a year, digging back into these fields at a serious level. I'm just learning an eyeful every day. But iron binds to oxygen, and that iron needs to be in a particular state, a chemical state. They call it an oxidation state. I won't get too technical, but it's all there if we want to look at it. But it needs to be in a particular, call it electrical state of charge for it to work. And by work, I mean for oxygen to bind to it. It's the only way it works. The iron will not bind to the oxygen if it's not in this state, this particular electrically charged chemical state. They call it the Fe3. Fe plus 3 state. You have iron in an elemental form, and then you have iron in a plus 2 state. This is when it loses a couple electrons, and then you have iron in a plus 3 state when it gets another electron taken from it. Iron in our bodies, primarily in the blood, exists in the Fe plus 2 state, and it is this state that is required for oxygen to bind to it.
Okay, I ask you this one thing? We have a close resemblance to chlorophyll, our blood, and would that also cross over and affect plants in a similar manner?
Absolutely fascinating question. It's what I have learned as well, the relationship between blood and chlorophyll from a chemical standpoint. A real handshake. Remember I was talking about how we are closer to other life forms than we might realize? That's a great example The parallels between that are fantastic. All I can say, you know, we ask one question, we have 1,000 more behind it, and all I can say is that part has struck me as incredibly curious also, okay, when you're starting to deal with these proteins and the binding mechanisms for this kind of thing. All I can say is right on in terms of what needs to be done, and yes, I wish I knew. But let's just say there's amazing similarities in terms of the chemical mechanisms of the proteins, basically, that are involved. So it's a great question. I wish I could answer it, but we don't even know the answers to the questions that I'm asking about here tonight is a part of the problem. But going back to this now, if we can, imagine that this iron needs to be in a certain state of existence in order for it to work in our body. The work is showing that this organism is using that iron, the iron in our bodies, for its own existence. By the way, this is not a stretch, as you will see in this paper. This paper is about 30 pages long. You'll find one whole section. What the heck is? You'll find, what is that one? Ah, that item on there. This paper is called Mergellon's Thesis, so you'd find it on the site. And if you go to item number 12, it's called Bacterial Requirements for Iron in the Blood. Well, I've learned that bacteria and iron go hand in hand. That's how bacteria live, folks. They love iron. So imagine, this is not imagine, the work shows that this organism is utilizing the iron for its own existence, which actually makes perfect sense if you start studying the biology of bacteria. And in the process, the iron is converted to a different state, namely that +3 state. It's converted to a different electrical chemical state, and in that conversion, it can no longer bind to oxygen.
So that kills respiration, right? I mean, that would affect respiration, right?
Absolutely. Okay. Big time. And, you know, it's been fascinating in terms of the education I'm going through right now. But this business of respiration is just incredible, too, because I think many people, they make the point of when you're first studying it, when you hear the word respiration, you think of breathing, that respiration is breathing. But respiration is actually not breathing. Breathing is, you know, that's the taking the air, inhalation, exhalation, right? But respiration is actually the process by which we acquire our energy to live. And what we're saying here is that the respiration process, as you have just mentioned, it's at the heart of it. It's not the act of breathing, but the act of respiration is a metabolic process of intake and conversion of energy to support our existence. That very nature of our existence is expected to be affected here in extremely significant ways. And that's the mild diplomatic way of summarizing a macro consequence of the effects of this organism, whatever we wish to call it, upon our bodies.
So ultimately, what I'm interpreting here is that we have, as though something has been introduced into our environment that can change life is the way we have known it. And then you introduce your metal salts, and which creates an electric field that could, all these things, anywhere from the radiation to all the aspects that you're talking about that's involved with this geoengineering, can affect life in a way that we've not known, right?
Yes, you've got it. That's for sure. You know, for people that want the sound bite from me, you know, what's it all about, Alfie? You know, the single word, if people force me and press me to come up with a single word that encompasses the net effect of everything I've seen over the, you know, 12 plus years, I can come to no other word than that of control.
And it's genetic modification on a global scale whether, I mean, and it appears that it has been introduced into the environment on purpose.
Yeah, I think this is fair. We have control in the most dire and serious ways that we could imagine, in unseen ways. We have systems that have the potential. Again, you can decide for yourself what you think is real or not, but the work shows that the mechanisms and the framework does exist for control of essentially all aspects. You know, when we're talking about physical, we're talking about environmental, we're talking about biological. You know, and I'm not a doomsdayer, folks, in terms of how I just call it as I see it. And just because a something exists doesn't mean that it's allowed to exist. It's, you know, it's our decision what we do about this information once we have it. But my goodness, just because something is there doesn't mean we are to submit to it. I'm just saying this is what I see. But yes, it would show the existence of systems and a framework for control in every significant conceivable manner in which you would want to exert it, is what it shows.
The ramifications are phenomenal. And what do you run into any of your peers or others that have observed the same things, maybe in an environment that do have access to labs? I have actually questioned a couple, and they're telling me that there is a change going on within the blood. And what are you hearing?
Well, I don't have, again, how would I say that? I go by, you know, show me the work, folks. I only lived in Missouri for 7 years, so I'm not completely tired. But, like, show me, okay? I mean, yes, there's an anecdotal part of our life that accompanies us all the time that's very interesting. But I have to operate by what I can see and what I can show and what other people will say and show me and that we will collectively act upon.
Okay.
And I don't – the body of work as it needs to be done has not been done. I've done the best that I can. And it's fair to say I think it's significant. But in terms of proper representation of the work through the proper channels, facility by channels, I don't mean authority. I mean in terms of competence and skill and resources and equipment. It's never been done, and I continue to seek it, and I seek it from day one. Yes, I can hear – you know, it's what I call stories or hearsay. I need to see the work to see what the digs are actually talking about. For 12 years, I've been saying, this is what I see, folks. Tell me what it is. Yes, I agree that things appear to be changing, and I hope the nonprofit is at least a facilitator in that process of realizing you don't have infinite time to sit around and dwell upon the possibilities or your belief systems as to whether something exists or not. You don't get away with that forever. And the time is far too long already. I mean, we are speaking of global consequences that are well entrenched. These are not hypothetical prospects. These are systems and effects that are entrenched upon the life and environmental state of this planet. And we can't sit around for another 20 years trying to figure out whether or not you have the proper credentials to be presenting your work. Go for the truth wherever it leads you, folks.
So if it's crossing species, then you've been able to observe this in plants as well, right? Or have you looked at that?
My work is almost entirely restricted right now to examination of blood samples and the culture samples. I have done some what I would call just tantalizing investigation of DNA extraction. There, actually, extraction of DNA is actually something that's accessible to all of us if we'd care to get involved. It's actually not that hard. Now, to see it is a whole different matter. I need $1 million, I think, to get through the other stuff I need to get to. But the actual process of extraction of DNA is actually not that difficult. And I have made some introductory investigations into the extraction of DNA, and so that involves foodstuffs and this type of thing for control work I've done. And there is a suggestion, and there'll be a paper to indicate that, just as a prospect, that what I'm speaking of does not appear at this point that it's fair for us to restrict ourselves to the human species. I have presented one paper involving study of animal blood with a limited sample. I actually have another project I made reference to that I need to we'll be able to extend that. But indeed, the animals examined did show the same basic organism I'm talking about and impact upon the blood. And then in addition, this is really, I'd call this weak in the sense I've only done it one time, and it's simply, I won't call it speculation because it's not, but I don't do things on a one-time basis to make the case. I'll do them over and over. But there is also some examination of foodstuffs in that DNA extraction. And all I can say is it appeared to indicate the existence of that very same structure within the foodstuff. But that work is far too premature to discuss in any kind of detail.
Okay, so ultimately you formed a nonprofit organization so that you can that you're able to receive funding to so that you can further your work, correct?
And this is true. I've tried to create a vehicle. I have to, you know, our lives are finite, folks. Eventually we'll all come to realize that. And I didn't anticipate, you know, 14 years later that this would become a significant part of my existence on this planet in terms of this work I'm doing. I didn't necessarily know where that was going. It's interesting to imagine that I was 44 or so, 45 years old when I started this stuff. So as we age and as we realize the consequences of what's going on, I have to come to terms with where do we go from here or where do we go in the future. And yes, I have been frustrated over these 12 years by the lack of actual the proper facilities, equipment, those things that we all say we want to get the answers, and people asking for those answers for over a decade and just getting stonewalled across the board, deliberately stonewalled. I do use the word covert global operation because everything says that this is indeed a covert global operation. But I do not have the resources or means to do what needs to be done. And so what I have done is simply ask, what is the best thing that I can do to pave the way and establish a path for carrying on at the level that will need to be done at some point, whenever it's done? And my influence is relatively minor, but I do the best that I can. And that has prompted the creation of this nonprofit 3 years ago now. We're still in our infancy as far as I'm concerned, absolute infancy as far as I'm concerned, in terms of where we need to go. But I have established what I hope is a pathway and a vehicle for consolidation of the needs that exist on these issues that we're speaking of, as well as the actual organization has been created with an intent to encompass really literally anything and everything involving environmental health, education, and research. That's where it wants to go eventually. But these two particular topics are certainly enough to keep us busy in our decade and our lives regarding geoengineering and bioengineering. And so that's certainly the focal point of the nonprofit at this time. But the long-term vision is much more generalized to be a place for people to go and to speak without censorship or restriction, as long as the work is done in earnest and benefit to the public.
And so you've created the Carnicom Institute, and it's carnicominstitute.org, and where people could go to and participate and read about your work, but also to contribute. And ultimately, there is an immediacy about this, apparently, because, I mean, obviously, this kind of these events have been around for quite a while, and somebody's been working on this for years, decades, probably, or longer, right?
Yeah, that's correct. Again, I think as soon as human beings can get their hands on something, they'll do it. And it goes back as, you know, technology is a history, right? As soon as you can do something. And certainly we're speaking of decades of precedents that are established even in the, there are some individuals that prefer to seek documentation for the existence, to establish the reality of something. There are some individuals that have a pathway, and I'm not criticizing. It's helpful and necessary, but they rely upon existing documentation to prove the reality of a situation. And there are people that have done that, and I give them credit for their willingness and patience to do that. In my case, there is no body of documentation that exists describes the state of affairs that I'm speaking of. And there is another pathway that can be chosen, and that is basically original research. If it doesn't exist, then you do it. And that's the path that I have chosen in my life, because there is no body of documentation that will be available to us that will describe the nature and context of things as I see it. And in addition to your support for the nonprofit, which I appreciate very much, people are invited to consider participating and being a part and contributing in an organization as well. And they can make contact with through the website or the phone number on there to start that process if they would like. There is no end, absolutely. Decades, but at least take it as a decade of pure outright neglect at the level that we're speaking of, affecting the state of the environment and well-being on this planet. Imagine that being neglected on a global level, call it for the last 12 years, and imagine the needs that exist for that. You know, I worked for the federal government for 15 years or so. And in my mind, I could easily put an entire agency to work with a budget of a few billion dollars. I could put every one of them to work, and I'd probably still be strapped for cash in terms of what I know really needs to be done. Because imagine the neglect that has taken place, because it's not imagination. It's actual and factual, folks. This neglect has taken place by the agencies and governmental forces that are intended to act in our behalf. They have not done their job, I'm sorry to say, and we have endured the consequences of that.
And, well, you know, and one of the things that really came out of this, that where the immediacy of some of this, it's as though science fiction is here, and that this Morgellons condition, whatever you want to describe it as, is almost like the microcosm of aliens. I don't know how else to describe it, and I'm not really trying to make light of it. I'm just saying you've got life forms that are able to live their life cycle and take over our basic life process, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, we have our conditioning framework. We have, you know, we grow up under certain conditioning processes that tell us this is acceptable to think about. This is within your range of consideration. And other issues are considered generally to be taboo or to be marginalized. And we grew up this way. And it's sort of a shame that, I mean, at this state of affairs, it's like, if, you know, bring up your example, and it's not making light of it to me at all. You know, the prospect of what is the source of this? What are we speaking of? And what domain are we going to restrict ourselves to in the consideration of both its origin as well as its existence and manifestation on this planet? And so somebody brings up the word aliens, right? Like you do. And it's like, yeah, we might have this notion to treat it, you know, as humor. But the fact is, think about what you're saying. And the fact is, until you have the goods, until you have the answers, you're not allowed to exclude anything. And there's huge questions about the origin of this. But, and if you want to take the conventional route of science, go for it. That's what I do also. I try to be familiar with it. And at some point, you have to get past your notions about what you think is acceptable to consider in your work or not. And listen, you can, I could talk to you about a, you know, I don't know if your station is, well, it's not the PBS, but nevertheless, there's the Ames Research Center is a branch. I don't know if they're directly connected with NASA, but they certainly have their connections with them. Ames Research Center is a place, an agency that deals with the study of what they call exobiology, basically the life outside our planet and or solar system, whatever. It's life beyond Earth. There's a place that does this even in the mainstream. I can talk to you about a broadcast on this show where they're outright telling you, that the only conclusion you can make is that life actually exists in this entire universe by our by what we've done. What they're telling you is that we're sending spaceships up there, you know, our little probes that go around, and when we bring them back to Earth, they still have microbes on them. Okay? They couldn't kill them. There's things attached to the outside hull that go through the trips in outer space, and they come back and are still alive. They can still exist. And this is our stuff. Okay?
Okay.
It's like you have to consider realistically what it is you're going to open your mind up to first. And I don't know where it will go, but I know you can have a conventional study of biology that right now is increasingly conditioning and prepping, I would say, the human species to consider the possibility. And I'm not implying that this is a connection here with this particular organism. I'm just saying we have some unexplained things, and you don't restrict yourself on what you're willing to consider. But there's a conventional outline right now for the origin and development on this planet being a direct infusion of life from outside the planet. And it's not stretched. It's part of conventional mainstream scientific presentation because you can't deny it.
Well, you have to understand, too, that when you're dealing with organizations that almost seem like they're gatekeeping organizations as to being organized to accomplish the tasks that they claim they do, and yet at the same time, there's just such a – so much secrecy and compartmentalization going on, that and stating also the fact that you know, if man thought of it, you know, he's going to try to do it. So you can just imagine what could be going on that we haven't even fathomed, let alone had evidence of yet.
It's absolutely true. And the first rule to me is you have to be willing to think for yourself. You cannot accept a conditioning framework as setting your boundaries as to what you're first willing to consider. And then in this case, you know, what we're speaking of is, let alone that which we're thinking and imagining of, now we already have a whole body of consideration that we already know we need a decade of work on that's been neglected.
Right.
And we're behind the curve on who knows. We don't know. We do not know the long-term impact and consequences of what we're describing here, other than it would appear to be earth-changing proportions. I think that's fair to say.
Well, Clifford, I am so glad that you decided to stay longer because this
Yeah, that was a good trick, and I enjoyed it, too. It was wonderful.
Well, you would seem to go along with it, but I'm so grateful because you just have such a body of information that I think the public needs to be exposed to and to open their minds to the kind of research that you're doing, and that you're showing that anybody can get out there and start doing some of this work if they have a mind to and start looking at, around them and seeing what's going on around us, because a lot is going on.
It's very true, and it's very true that the Institute is asking for your help. That's what it's for, and the Institute is meant to be there when I'm not, and it's meant for you and anyone that wishes to contribute to the betterment of our world and the ensuring the right of life on this planet to exist under what I would call a higher order, as opposed to the machinations of human beings and the systems of control that they might develop.
Right, and I want to thank you, Clifford, and again, my guest has been Clifford Carnicom, and your institute is carnicominstitute.org, and it has your body of work on that site and carnicom.com, and that, again, you need support because obviously from what the things that you're uncovering here, we need to be paying attention to because it obviously will not be long before it starts. If it hasn't affected us yet, it soon will, right?
Yes, and unfortunately, I have to say, I'm sorry to say, or I must say, that actually everything says that it is affecting us. It's beyond the point of something in the future. It is something that is in place, and we need to it's not a matter of just being aware. We need to be engaged.
Okay, and thank you, and continue the good work, and I hope my audience understands and does something about it as well. So, again, thank you, Clifford.
Melody, thank you very much for the opportunity and invitation to be here tonight, and I'll still have time to look at the blood afterwards.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah,
good
thanks
night.
A whole lot.
Good night.
Bye-bye now.
Okay, that was a great interview. I've been following his work for quite a while, and it ties right into with some of the subjects that I've been trying to cover in the last, well, we've covered around in and around it over the years, but in the last month or two, we've been trying to focus on the geoengineering and the ramifications and places that it can be going.